session number 10644, reel 3.
Easton, reel 3.
So once again, there I was out in the middle of the sea, not knowing which direction to go, having done my various searches, getting nothing from the beacon. But I knew we were north of Freetown, because I knew we were going to call in at Freetown on the way around Syria. And I knew we were somewhere off the west coast of Africa, but I had no idea how many miles we were off. Anyway, they seemed to have no choice but to turn east and hope to reach the coast of Africa. So we just simply flew in at maximum economical speed, weak mixture, and we, in fact, were, the gauge was flickering between nothing and a few gallons when we did see the coast of Africa. I had very little choice as to what to do about it. But I did see again what looked like a just possible piece of long grass, a fairly flat area with very long grass, but it did look reasonably flat. And I could make no circuit of it. I really had to go straight into it. And I decided, again, I'd try with my wheels down because I thought I might be able to wireless to Freetown and get some petrol sent up and be able to get her going again. But once again, it was this time it was even softer than in Norway. It was marsh. And we very quickly were upside down. And there we hung until we hooked ourselves and got out, and we were in a marsh and coast of Africa, which actually turned out to be in French Guinea at the time. Really wasn't very long after we had got out of there that a great crowd of natives arrived, and amongst them were two of Tiraya, and we were taken to a village. My air gunner and I recall we were sat down on two big, sort of rather ceremonial-looking logs. The village was sort of lined up in a great line on either side, stretching away from us. And we were presented with an egg each and a cola nut. Fortunately, my air gunner, who was Welsh, knew how to eat an egg by making a hole in it and sucking it through, which I hadn't previously done. Certainly hadn't had any breakfast, and I was quite hungry. When I chewed into the cola nut, it was extremely bitter, and I threw it away, and it was immediately pounced on by some of the natives, but of course it turned out that it was a rather something of a delicacy and an aphrodisiac, I understand, that we had been given as a... Anyway, shortly after that, a group of Tiraya's arrived, and two white men, and we were marched away.
What was their attitude towards you?
Their attitude was the white chaps were quite friendly. I must just say that my air gunner really at one time did think he was going to be eaten when we were first taken over by the village, really, and because the natives were highly excited, and although I was able to understand roughly what was being said because they were speaking a sort of pidgin French and I could speak French quite well. He had never been outside Wales, so he was a very young man. And to suddenly find himself surrounded by these incredible people shouting in weird tongues and looking very hostile, certainly, and very agitated. I think he thought we were going to be the victims of a cannibal soup. But... anyway, we actually spent that night the first part of the evening in a planter's bungalow where we were fed. There were these two French planters who were the people who had come and picked us up, and we had landed fairly close to them. And then we were put into a sort of native jail for the night with a tiraya outside, and it was just a simple cell, really. But they threw a mattress into each one. And they were perfectly friendly in attitude, but they had been, I think, in touch with the French authorities, and the French authorities said you'd lock them up. Because it was sometime in the evening when suddenly the things changed slightly and we were taken out and put in these things when previously we never very easy to understand what the French attitude to any of these things was going to be. I mean, if I can just go back a moment to the Dakar business, because some of the people I later met in the camp in French West Africa had been shot down at Dakar. They had been taken in the first instance up to the mess of one of the French infantry battalions north of Dakar, which was, and they'd been taken away and given a wonderful picnic on the cliffs waiting for the British invasion to come in, which they were going to watch from there. And there was going to be no opposition to them at all. But, of course, when de Gaulle first landed, he landed elsewhere, and he landed where, unfortunately, where the where the resistance was strongest, where the chaps from metropolitan France had just arrived. So the French were always very ambivalent, and we never really quite knew what their attitude was. And I had no idea whether French Guinea was part of de Gaulle's empire or part of the Vichy Empire at that stage. Anyway, I think there's perhaps one little incident might be worth mentioning. We, for the first time, the Fulmers, the first time as fighters, we had IFF, indication friend or foe. This was a highly secret device, of course, which indicated on radar whether you were friend or not. We had a, if I recall rightly, it had a device which could explode the thing in the aircraft, so that if your aircraft was going to be taken or something, you would press a button and it would explode it, which would just blow out the insides of the IFF or something like that. Any case, I remember pushing the button as we came into land, but before we landed, in the marsh before we turned upside down and so forth. My air gunner had said nothing had happened. So anyway, there we were. I had this plane there, and I was rather concerned about this IFF, which hadn't apparently destroyed. And it was some time later when we were in the... Because ultimately we went from Guinea, we were taken, and after spending the night in Clink there, we were put in a plane. We were taken to an airport, put in a plane, and flown up to Dakar. And at Dakar, I was visited by the American consul. And I had written, when I first arrived at Dakar, a thing in French for the French, saying I was I didn't want the French to. I wanted the French to realize that there was an instrument in the aircraft that was wired up with explosives, and if it was not very, you know, if you were not very careful, what you had to do was cut all the wires to it. I described what it looked like. Otherwise, the whole aircraft might explode. And it was best, the best thing to do would be to put it in the marsh and explode it by rifle fire. But it was... I think what I had effectively said was that this was a thing that looked like an instrument but was in fact explosive, which would blow out the aircraft if people tampered with it. So I never knew what happened to that until when I did meet the American consul in Dakar later. He said, oh, you'd be interested to hear that they had cut all the wires to this thing. They had taken it out very gingerly. They'd put it in the marsh and they'd fired rounds. Whether the rounds did any damage to the thing, I don't ever made it impossible to follow it. I don't know, but anyway, so we found ourselves then, my air gunner and I, in our artillery barracks at Dakar, where we were locked up, and we spent a number of months there. We made one breakout, climbing through. Loosening and thing of climbing through the skylights above the door at the back of the thing, but unfortunately we chose a time when there just a large number of people had arrived at the barracks and were couldn't be accommodated and were camped around very close to us, and we ran more or less straight into them.
Where would you have tried to get to if you had got away?
Well, we were going to try to get to the airport and steal an aircraft. I mean, it was a ridiculous idea in many ways, but that was our plan. We did have messages which we passed from time to time with some sous-officiers who were trying to plan an escape with us. And they had told us where the airplanes were. And if I recall rightly, there were some Harvards there. There were certainly aircraft that I felt we would be able to fly, and if we could get to one, solid up and go. But and indeed, after we'd been in the artillery barracks for something like 4 or 5 months, if I recall rightly, we were told we were going to be transferred up country to Kulikoro. So the planning to try and do an escape intensified, and quite a big arrangement was set up with these sous-officiers, who I think were totally reliable. We used to leave messages in the shower, that's how we communicated, really. And also, there was a time when every Saturday night, a bag of oysters would be thrown over the balcony into where we were. And I suppose I was probably one of the only prisoners of war who was eating oysters on a Saturday night at that time. They were very good. We had to learn how to open them, but they were excellent. And so then one or two messages used to turn out that way too. But in any case, these chaps had said that they would arrange for arrive at the station at a certain time. There'd be very few guards. We would be able to dash out of something, turn some corner. There'd be a car waiting. We'd be taken to the airport and the signal. Anyway, it all looked extremely hairy. And I said, we were very dubious whether we could do anything about it. But I think they were quite keen we should have a go. Actually, in fact, when we were taken, we were heavily guarded. There wasn't any possibility of breaking free. And whether they had cars and whether they had these things set up, I really don't know. But we then went by train a very long way inland and up to Kulikoro, which is up beyond Bamako, about 75 miles further north than Bamako, and almost the next town north is Timbuktu. Indeed, my parents, I think, received a message to say that I was now imprisoned in Timbuktu. But there we joined this prison camp, which was a very heterogeneous collection of people, because apart from one or two of the pilots, near gunners, who'd been shot down at the time of the Dhaka affair, there was just the mixed bag crew of a ship that had been sailing, I think, under a Greek flag, and that had mutinied in Dhaka harbour. And although some of them were British, some of them were Greek, and some of them were Australian, and we were all put together. They were the most extraordinary bunch of people. We were all put together in a warehouse on the up above the Niger River in this place, Kulikoro, with barbed wire around us, miles from anywhere. The Australians, I recall, detested the British officers. Because I think their plummy, pommy voices drove them insane. We were regaled by the most astonishing stories, because some of these people had been pimps and others had been robbers and others had been things. And after we'd all got to know each other, they were fairly free in their discussions of how they used to operate their criminal or semi-criminal lives. There was a Carib from the West Indies who taught us how to make paints out of vegetables and nuts and this and the other, so that we all decorated the whitewashed walls of our warehouse rooms. I mean, the accommodation simply consisted of bare rooms in which there were bamboo tara sort of beds, you know, with mosquito nets. And But it wasn't too bad. I mean, it was very constricted. There was nothing to do. We had no Red Cross parcels. We had no books. We had practically nothing but playing cards, actually. And it was hot as blazes. But it wasn't impossible. And the food was okay, and just bearable, perfectly all right. And every now and then, the French would send in great bidons of red wine, and we'd get absolutely as drunk as skunks, of course. And when we were as drunk as skunks, we would start shouting obscenities at the French, and the French sous-officiers would come down from their mess and start shouting obscenities at us. There were always a lot to be said about Dunkirk. We hadn't taken the French off at Dunkirk or one thing and another, and we had a few things to say about the French. And then we'd start throwing stones at each other, stones and mangoes and anything that came to hand, which was a tremendous relief, really, because you'd be dodging in around the compound, hurling things at your enemy, and they were hurling them back at you. It was pretty primitive, really. There was a time when one of these Australians, I think he was really a bit nuts, tried to murder the senior officer with a knife. He leapt out at him. But there was unfortunately, the chap swerved and he missed, and someone else was on top of the Australian very quickly. Shortly after that, all these civilians, the mutineers, were simply disappeared. They went off to various places. I think a number of them, I think, joined the Foreign Legion or something, and others were just taken away somewhere else. I don't know where they went, but they went. And for a very short while, we were stayed on in the warehouse. But we'd been watching next door to us in a sort of compound that had been created next to the warehouse. They had built up a lot of mud huts, and we didn't know what these were for, but we found they were for us. And we were joined by 80 merchant seamen who had come ashore in various parts of the French African possessions from ships torpedoed in the Atlantic. Many of them had been drinking their own urine before they arrived and were in a very odd state, of course. The 80 of these, together with a handful of us, formed the new prison camp. And the new prison camp was in mud huts, totally bare, just nothing but mud huts with a bamboo tarot in them, and thatch roofs from which the termites used to drop all the time. And a dramatic change in the food, because we no longer... And a dramatic change in the food, because suddenly there was practically nothing to eat but mangoes and rice all day and nothing else. And the toilet facilities for the whole lot of us were one hole in the ground with a plank across it, right out in the open, used by, I suppose, what was then about 90 people or something. And there, so the plank was very quickly slippery, and the whole thing was absolutely intolerable. Anyway, I became very ill there, and I went off to the local hospital, where I went down to 7 stone and was expected to die, when a French doctor was interned in the hospital on sort of a résidence survey, where he'd been operating up in the bush, and he'd had people sending BBC news bulletins up in the bush, and this had upset the Vichy people who had brought him back to Dakar on the résidence survey. He was very pro de Gaulle, and he had read some Japanese medical magazine where it said that the best treatment for spirochetes, first of all, he diagnosed it as spirochetal jaundice. He had a look at me, and then the cure for it was injections of arsenic. So I then had my arsenic injections from him, and really rather rapidly got better and went back to rejoin the camp. But when I rejoined the camp, it had changed again. All the merchant seamen had been exchanged against Frenchmen held somewhere, and we were out of the mud huts, and we were in a little European transit bungalow up above the railway and the river on a sort of little hill. And there was this little bungalows just surrounded by barbed wire, and there we had our black guards, and there we were. Well, now, this place turned out to be, this was very much more civilized for a considerable while. We were able to employ a French, a black cook. We were able to get a sort of goat meat. There was a vegetable garden which grew European vegetables, not very far off, that we were allowed to go and buy vegetables from. We started to get Red Cross parcels. Life was looking up. It was a strange group of people because, again, apart from our initial pilots and air gunners, there were now some New Zealanders who had come from, who'd landed and been forced down in aircraft somewhere in Africa. They were doing, I think, transiting Africa for the North African build-up on them. And there were also black political prisoners and white political prisoners. Indeed, we had a chemist from Bamako who had been arrested for getting drunk one day at the station buffet and breaking a bottle and shouting Vive de Gaulle and encouraging and challenging anyone to come and deny Vive de Gaulle and get a broken bottle in the face. Anyway, he'd been arrested and he'd been sent to us. Not too long afterwards, up through the bush from the railway station came a very dramatic figure in gold and white, who turned out to be under guard, who turned out to be the assistant police commissioner from Dhaka, who had been told when they'd received certain orders to take certain measures against the Jews. He himself was a Jew. He'd written Maird on his order paper and gone out to lunch. His deputy or someone in his office had then reported his comment on these orders. And he had been arrested, and he was sent up to join us. But it also turned out he'd been a co-respondent in the chemist's divorce, first divorce. The chemist had remarried a Polish girl, but he had been divorced because this chap had been the co-respondent. So the chemist wanted to kill him, and so forth. Anyway, the French political prisoners, the black political prisoners were people who had agitated for independence, I think. And they were a growing number, I suppose we had about five or six of them. We were very crowded in this place. I'm not a racist, but I must say, living in very close proximity, one didn't notice two things. It was impossible to get the blacks to do their share of the work, like when it was awful things like having to dig up the loos and things because it was all choked up, or doing various things like that. We also used to make furniture, and we made furniture and gave it to blacks when they arrived. But when some other New Zealanders arrived, and they hadn't made any themselves, we took some back from them for the New Zealanders, and that caused a bit of a furore. Also, of course, when Ramadan came round, they had some rather peculiar habits that weren't very attractive to the rest of us, and
because of the prohibition on eating and drinking.
Well, yes. I mean, they were in each other's beds all night. You see, hammering away at each other once the light things had gone down, and they have their feasting and their sexual gratification and things. It wasn't very good, but it was a most remarkable place. I mean, there's no doubt about it. It was because we were such a very, very mixed bag, and the hell we got on the whole. I mean, you know, we weren't at each other's throats. It was only when if the wine came pouring in, you know, if we did. I mean, I remember Christmas when we all got very drunk, of course. We were, just these great sort of glass bidons of wine were brought to us, which were very raw stuff, but excellent. And we would drink ourselves stupid on the first night, of course. We finished it all off very quickly. But over the Christmas, I remember we had arranged through the Polish wife of the chemist, the second wife, we'd arranged for some ducks for Christmas dinner, and she had brought all these ducks. She was allowed to spend Christmas with us, only woman in the place. We had this fantastic feast of ducks and wine on a Christmas day. which went down very well. But it ended up, of course, when she then left, and then part of the night was spent trying to guard the French police commissioner from the other guy who had a knife and was constantly trying to murder him, or stating that he was going to murder him and shouting at him and yelling. But we ran our own sort of classes of things, you know. We tried to learn German and shorthand, and anyone who knew anything, there was one Cambridge historian, you know, a young student from history, he did history, and we all taught something, and we all, you know, passed the time that way, really. And we stayed there until North Africa was invaded, and not very long after North Africa was invaded, the Boisson, who was the governor general, threw in his lot with de Gaulle, and we were eventually packed up into trains, and we went down to, and we arrived in Bathurst. There's a silly anecdote about Bathurst, really, because we were installed in a Malayan River steamer that had found its way to Bathurst, and we were put on board her. The naval officer in charge in Bathurst had gone away on holiday fishing, but he knew we were arriving and had apparently made a good deal of stores and food of semi-luxurious, very luxurious to us, of course, at that time, nature available to be put on board this boat for us. But in fact, when we arrived on board the boat and lived there, we found that we would be sitting at a table with one or two of the officers, and we'd be eating one lot of very simple food while they would be eating far more attractive-looking meals. And so I went ashore. Johnny Crabb, who was our senior officer, was sick with malaria at the time. Incidentally, we'd all had a lot of malaria throughout the period. And I went to the naval officers' offices, and I found out that this food had all been put on board, which was the first we'd heard about it. Went back and made a few inquiries and found that the captain of the ship had it all put in his private store cupboard. So, we were being fed on rice and very simple stuff. I was so angry at the time that I went straight up to the bridge of this thing where the captain was playing bridge with two of our officers and one of his. And I picked the table up with its drinks and its cards and tipped them into his lap, which I subsequently regretted, but I was at the time really very angry indeed. And